Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Well, we had a surprise entrant, or possibly not entrant, into the Labour leadership contest last night. Katie, reveal who the new big name is or isn't.
Just waiting for the drum roll sound effect. Cindy? So we now have Barry Gardiner. Now, Barry Gardiner, for those who sadly are not yet aware of Barry Gardiner, is the Shadow International Trade Secretary, and he is a Corbyn ally, and he has suggested that he could be running. Now, he hasn't 100% confirmed this. There are currently 6 confirmed candidates in the Labour leadership race, but he's given quite strong hints that it could be on the way. So not only do friends of Barry Gardiner say he was seriously considering it, he's also said himself that he is seriously considering it. He's gone a bit further today. He's appeared on the Victoria Derbyshire show, where he said that he, again, wasn't 100% sure he was going to throw his hat in, but just to be clear, he could definitely win the election, or at least that's what lots of people have told him. Now, how does a potential Barry Gardiner bid fit into the leadership race? I think that in terms of the part of the membership, or even the group of MPs he is going for, they're more on the Corbyn end of the spectrum. I think that if you look a lot about how Rebecca Long-Bailey has fared, I think it is fair to say that her campaign has been a bit troubled so far, and there are some who are having doubts about her. So you had Ian Lavery considering putting his hat in. He decided not to. He's got behind Rebecca Long-Bailey. I think the fact that Barry Gardiner is going for it, in a way, Barry Gardiner is someone who is quite confident. Lots of people who work in political journalism find him a source of quite regular amusement. But the fact that he thinks he has support, to me, suggests that, again, people who want there to be a successor of Corbyn who is more on a continuity level than a change are wondering whether or not Rebecca Long-Bailey can actually do that, and perhaps they need a different candidate. Whether or not the answer is Barry Gardiner, I think, is a different conversation.
James, do you think Barry Gardiner can get the sufficient level of support from MPs? He's only got 4 days until candidates all have to declare. He doesn't have very much time to go around colleagues and to drum up support. And some of the other shadow cabinet members, Emily Thornberry, for instance, are really struggling to get support. And he's declaring very late.
Yes, I think it's going to be a struggle for him to get the requisite number of MPs nominations unless he gets some heavyweight support from somewhere, and something that can kind of unlock a particular box of MPs, a block of MPs even. And it's quite interesting, last night Len McCluskey was heatedly denying that he was behind this Barry Gardiner bid, etc., etc. But I think, as Katie said, this makes life difficult for Rebecca Long-Bailey, because it just adds to a sense that she's underwhelming. And I think that is a problem for her, in that, you know, what won Jeremy Corbyn the leadership the first time round was enthusiasm. And I don't think we're not seeing kind of Long-Bailey mania yet.
In terms of the wider contest, we had Keir Starmer yesterday being the first candidate to reach the threshold of support from MPs. He's gone over the 22 required to pass through the first phase in this contest. Katie, he's the front runner. Rebecca Long-Bailey is tied in second place now with Lisa Nandy. So let's just talk about Lisa Nandy's campaign. Who's she appealing to?
I think if you look at Lisa Nandy, she is seen as being soft left in terms of the party. There's also a sense, if you speak to some, that because she's talking a lot about how you would rebuild the Red Wall and appeal to seats in the middle and the north, whether or not it's actually her pitch, there's a whiff of Blue Labour to it. I think that if you look at her, she's actually taking lots of different elements. I don't think she's easy to pin down into one direction in terms of her campaign. I think that she clearly impressed this week when she spoke at the hustings in front of parliamentary colleagues. And I think that there was a point, and it's still not 100% clear she is going to meet the MP threshold, but it seems as though she is picking up momentum, not the group, just, you know, pace amongst her colleagues. And I think that lots of MPs in the Labour Party are very sceptical of the idea about lending their nominations to anyone because they remember they remember what happened in 2015 with Jeremy Corbyn. But I do think with Lisa Nandy, some of these candidates who now look very assured to get to that stage, including Keir Starmer, some MPs are now thinking about, actually, should I help Lisa Nandy through? Because she could actually be quite an interesting voice in this debate if you get through to the hustings level, because she is going to be talking a lot about these seats. And I think one of the worries about Keir Starmer is he says he's past the second referendum point, that he no longer thinks the EU should be the issue of the day. But some of his comments in Shadow Cabinet recently, and also just the fact his campaign's been so slick, I think means that people are not 100% sure he necessarily means everything he's saying. Perhaps it's just quite cleverly packaged. And I think there's a sense that having someone like Lisa Nandy in those stages to make sure those areas were being talked about.
I think Lisa Nandy has a slight whiff of David Cameron in 2005 to her at the moment, in that she's just kind of outperforming expectations. The more her colleagues have seen of her, the more impressed they are. And as Katie said, a bit like Cameron in 2005, she's not entirely simple to categorise which bit of the party she comes from, in that she's kind of taking, you know, something borrowed, something blue, you know. I mean, it's, you can see how she could kind of pull together a different Labour coalition internally that van has existed before. And I do wonder, my kind of slight question about Keir Starmer is, what do you think the route to Labour having 326 seats with Keir Starmer is? You know, which seats is he going to win? Now, he's obviously trying to help himself. He's had Jenny Chapman, who was the Labour MP for Darlington until they lost the seat at the election, is going to be, you know, taking on a key role in his campaign, and she was one of his deputies on the shadow Brexit team. But again, it's hard, you know, when you look at why Labour lost in lots of these places, you know, it's undoubtedly, I think it was a combination of Brexit and Corbyn, and he's not, obviously not Jeremy Corbyn, but you know, Keir Starmer was the most pro-Remain, pro-second referendum voice in the shadow cabinet, something that, you know, he doesn't shy away from. But you know, is he the right person to win back those places? And I also wonder, you know, as we were all talking about yesterday, you know, is another North London MP, if you worry about sending a symbol that you haven't listened to the election result, you know, I mean, I live in North London, there is nothing wrong with North London.
But there's plenty wrong with North London, James.
But does going for someone from the same milieu risk sending a message of, you know, fingers in your ears kind of sound?
Moving on to Brexit, Michel Barnier has said today that it will be impossible to get a trade deal within the deadline that the UK wants to set. James, is this significant?
Yeah, I think it is, because I think the two sides, right now, this is obviously, you know, no negotiating mandates means that the two sides are very far apart right now. Boris Johnson is completely adamant that he is not extending past the end of this year. I keep saying December 2020 when it is 2020. So that, I think, is a hard and fast deadline for him. He is also absolutely clear that the whole point of Brexit was to diverge. And so, while on the EU side, they keep saying, well, it'll be very hard to get a deal done by December 2020. And, you know, the quickest way to speed talks along is to align with us, with the EU standards. And I also think one other thing which is noticeable is Barnier and von der Leyen yesterday are both making this point about no dumping. And that is kind of EU code for you must continue to follow EU social and environmental rules. Again, I think, you know, it's not that Boris Johnson wants to cut those standards, but he has a kind of almost, he has a kind of democratic objection to the idea that the UK is going to sign up to following something which is not set in its own parliament. So you can, and you can see the ingredients for a smash here, in that both sides are very confident of the strength of their position. The EU believes that the ticking, Barnier's infamous ticking clock, means that they've ultimately got Boris Johnson over a barrel and he'll have to back down. While as Boris Johnson is, you know, I've got a majority in Parliament, something that Theresa May never had, I've got a mandate, you know, and I am not going beyond December 2020.
Now, in this week's Spectator, James, you've revealed what Boris Johnson's Brexit plan is. Just tease listeners with a few of your revelations that you've got in this piece.
So I think the most important shift is that this starts from a presumption of divergence. I think under Theresa May, if you look at the Chequers deal, this is clearly clear that that starts from a presumption of alignment. If you wanted to, in a particular sector, diverge from EU rules, you had to kind of make the case and win the argument. Here, Boris Johnson starts from a strong presumption of divergence. He needs to be persuaded why in any sector it is worth aligning with EU rules. And that I think is the big profound difference. You know, I was talking to someone in Whitehall the other day and they were saying, you know, essentially under May, departments were very reluctant to get into anything about the benefits of Brexit, in inverted commas, because what they worried was that you'd say, after Brexit, we'll be able to do this. And then the eventual deal that the UK would strike with the EU would require the EU to be in lockstep with the EU on that point, so it wouldn't have the freedom to do that. Now, the word has gone forth from number 10, you know, go and talk about the opportunities of Brexit, the freedoms that you'll have, because, you know, those aren't, you know, they are very confident that they're not going to negotiate those away. And I think that tells you the difference. Now, some people will say, oh, this all sounds terribly like, you know, the confidence that the May team had going into phase one. And there is some truth to that. I would say two things that are very different, though. One is, what really handicapped Theresa May was that she couldn't get her cabinet to a common position. And that was even before you got to kind of Parliament tying her hands and all this. Boris Johnson doesn't have those problems. You know, his cabinet is going to follow him and he's got the numbers in Parliament. And I mean, the second thing I would add is, you know, you could say that the 2019 election strategy was the same election strategy as 2017. This Downing Street is just better than Theresa May's Downing Street at implementing a strategy. And that doesn't change the fundamental nature of the negotiations, but I think it does make a difference at the margins.
Katie, one of the plans for this year from Johnson and his aides is to not talk about Brexit after the end of this month. Now, James obviously sets out how that's going to be quite difficult. Are they going to come up with another name?
Look, I think Brexit will be discussed. It's just the idea is that you're going to try and limit it. And I think there's going to be a big effort to try and focus on domestic policy and domestic reform, talking about various things they're doing, such as, you know, plans they have for the NHS and trying to make the conversation there. So even though Brexit will be going on, the idea is it will be going on in the background. I think for all the reasons James just outlined, however, it's going to be a hard task to de-dramatise Brexit to the point that they want to, because you ultimately are going to have a difficult negotiation going on behind the scenes. But I think the fact that you clearly have Dex, who is no more, I think you have David Frost leading things from inside number 10, I think there is going to be an effort to move it away from having politicians, you know, cabinet ministers leading front and centre, and hope through doing that it gets less attention. But people are going to want to scrutinise what's going on. And I also think that if you look at some of the things that James outlines in his piece, such as the idea of fishing and the fact that the EU might want to make this an issue at the beginning. Now, people say that's not a big issue for the UK economy, but it's clearly a very politically potent issue, the common fishery policy, particularly in Scotland. So you can start to see, if the UK refuse to budge, or if they do budge on something like that, it's going to have big political ramifications, I think. So I think they will try and limit how many times they say Brexit. We've heard, you know, stories of how it's being taken out of speeches when you sent them to number 10 to get approval. Your speech comes back and you thought you were probably being helpful by saying get Brexit done, because that was said so much in the election, but it's one of the things that hasn't passed on. But ultimately, it's going to be impossible to remove it altogether.
I think it's funny at Cabinet, what day is it today? Thursday. So Cabinet on Tuesday, so 2 days ago, Boris Johnson again told ministers, you know, banish Brexit from your lexicon. You know, it's got to go. It used to be get Brexit done. He now says banish Brexit. This is his new little kind of catchphrase to tell everyone. But I think ultimately they are going to need to come up with some snappy phrase to describe this EU-UK trade deal if they're going to get Brexit out of our kind of linguistic memory, because it is such a memorable phrase. It's just very hard not to use it when discussing UK-EU relations.
Well, we'd love to hear your suggestions for the new word for Brexit. If you want to email them to podcast@spectator.co.uk, we'll read out some of the best ones on a future episode. Finally, Barry Gardner's campaign launch/not launch was rather overshadowed in a sign of how frightened the establishment is by the potential Labour leadership contender. Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle put out an extraordinary statement last night in which they announced that they were basically resigning from the royal family and splitting their time between North America and the UK as they tried to become financially independent. This was then followed by Buckingham Palace basically saying that they hadn't cleared this with them and that discussions were at an early stage. And then there were briefings off the record that the Queen was very hurt and disappointed by this. James, you think this is very significant for politics as well as for those who are obsessed with the royal family?
I think it has a political issue because they're not planning to give up their titles. They will still be royals. And they already have, I think, kind of pushed the boundaries in terms of royal political neutrality, some of the causes they've got interested in and involved in. And you have to think that they're going to become even more political in this new iteration. And I think that is good. That does potentially pose big problems, which is, you know, I mean, it is worth remembering how nervous the major government were made by Princess Diana's campaigning against landmines. You know, she had given up her HRH, you know, she was divorced from Prince Charles, but, you know, there was still a feeling that this was politically sensitive, especially in terms of how foreign governments would react. You know, for example, if Meghan Markle in time starts to, you know, make clear her views on Donald Trump, you know, how does the UK government deal with that? How does the UK government deal if Harry and Meghan's foundation starts being kind of explicitly critical of governments that the UK wants to maintain friendly relations with? You know, how do you persuade them that, you know, this is nothing to do with us when, you know,
they're rogue royals.
Yeah, exactly. When he is, you know, he is either the grandson of the monarch or the son of the monarch. You know, this is going to be quite tricky diplomatic waters. And also, you know, it raises another question, which is, you know, when their foundation is doing stuff, you know, what level of support will Britain's diplomatic network or embassies afford them? You know, this is going to create a grey area that no one quite knows how to navigate, I think.
Katie.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just many unanswered questions, and it's partly because they rushed this out, and clearly, as the panel suggests, they don't know everything. But, you know, they're suggesting they're on the way to financial independence, so we don't yet know, yes, out of the sovereign grant, but it sounds as though they will keep their Frogmore Cottage, which I don't believe looks like a typical cottage, and has had several million pounds of taxpayers' money used for revamp to it, and also, obviously, the money from Prince Charles, which some say, if you look at the estate, actually isn't so much a private income as perhaps others would tell you it was. So I think there's big questions about how they're actually being funded.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And you can listen to this podcast and all our other podcasts on the iTunes Store and many other excellent podcast apps. And for those who are special fans of this podcast, we have an event coming up called Shots Live, which is not a drinking game, but a recording of Coffee House Shots podcast with Katie Balls, James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson, and special guests yet to be announced. It's on the 29th of January, and to get tickets, you go to spectator.co.uk/liveshots. Thanks for listening.